This week on Snark Squad Pod, we're joined by Kat O'Keefe to talk about 2019's Men in Black International. Welcome back to Snark Squad Pod. My name is Marines.
I'm Nicole Sweeney, and we are joined once again by our friend Kat.
Hi, I'm Kat O'Keefe. I make videos on YouTube about books and writing and storytelling, but I spend most of my time on Twitter.
And Kat is back again this week, not to talk about books, but to talk about Men in Black International. This is a soft reboot, spin-off, I don't know what you want to call it, from the original Men in Black trilogy. This time, we start off with Tessa Thompson playing a character named Molly, who, as a small child, witnesses an alien encounter, and she sees her parents' memories wiped with the famous Men in Black memory wiping gadget, but her memory isn't wiped. So she, you know, spends the rest of her life knowing that this thing happened, and nobody believes her, and they think she's delusional. She's clearly super smart because she manages to, you know, potentially get a job with all sorts of spy agency organizations. And every time she gets to sort of the question of like, all right, so what are you interested in doing? She keeps hinting that she wants to be in the, like, the secret division, the one you don't tell people about. And everyone's like, we have no idea what you're talking about. Because she's trying to find basically the people who wiped her parents' memory of this weird little soft fuzzy tarantula alien that she saw as a child. Eventually, she does find the Men in Black, and she has this big dramatic moment where they're, you know, gonna wipe her memory, and she's like, no, I found you. So, like, that's why I belong here. Like, I found you. So I'm perfect for this job. Also, I have no life, which similarly makes me perfect for this job. And Emma Thompson is like, yes, you're right. That does make you perfect for this job. And so she ships her off to the London office, which we got sort of a little like prologue-y teaser of a 2016 apocalypse being averted in Paris by Liam Neeson and Chris Hemsworth. I pulled up everyone's names so that I could have them handy, but I'm just going to refer to them by their actor names. I don't know why I bothered. So anyway, shortly after arriving in the London office, Tessa Thompson realizes that Chris Hemsworth is like kind of the like hotshot agent in the London office. Liam Neeson is like the head of the office. And so Tessa Thompson ingratiates herself with Chris Hemsworth, and they end up teaming up. There is this whole to-do because the aliens from the like prologue-y apocalypse situation are potentially back on Earth. And so Liam Neeson assigns Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson to go try and figure out what's going on. And so they go on a whole big adventure, hijinks ensue, they save the day, only it turns out in the end that, like, actually Liam Neeson isn't really Liam Neeson anymore, and he was, what's, like, body snatched, I guess, by the apocalyptic aliens from the beginning of the movie. And so then he goes, like, full alien at the end, trying to destroy the Earth. And just in the nick of time, Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson save the day. And then Chris Hemsworth gets to be the new head of the London office, and Tessa Thompson has to go back to New York. The end.
This is where we typically start with our gut check of, did you like this? But before we get there, I have a leading question of what your relationship with the other Men in Black stuff is, if any. Like, have you watched it? Did you like it? What's the deal there? Do you know the Will Smith song about the Men in Black? That's really what I want to know.
Yes, I do know that song. I did. I don't know if I watched all the movies in the original trilogy. I feel like I saw the first two at least, but it must have been like 15 years ago. So it's been a while. Don't have much memory about it, but I do remember enjoying them. They were fun movies.
I definitely watched all of them. I was thinking about this after we finished recording our coming of age episode, last week's episode, because I didn't really have, good answers in terms of what my coming of age media was, in part because during preteen years, early adolescence, late childhood, I most of what I was consuming was like the action and horror that my older brother was into. So like my stuff wasn't necessarily coming of age stuff. It was like, you know, I don't know, explosion movies that Josh watched. So, which definitely included the Men in Black movies. And obviously I am very familiar with the all important song. So yes, this was definitely a big part of, you know, stuff that I was consuming as a kid. Have not watched them since then, like as an adult. It's been a lot of years, and so my memories are super hazy, but I had like strong experiences with them as a kid.
I definitely watched the first one. I suspect that I watched the second one, but I don't remember. And I definitely didn't watch the third one that I didn't even know existed. Somehow in 2012, I was doing something and completely missed that there was a third Men in Black movie. So I rewatched the first one multiple times, and leaving the theater, my initial reaction was, well, now I want to watch the original, which I don't know, Amazon probably knew and you had to rent it. It wasn't like on Prime. It was like a cash grab.
I guess technically I did the third one. I was an adult. I feel like I have to now clarify then that technically I was an adult when the third one came out. But yes, anyway, sorry, continue. I lied.
I mean, the fact that it came out in 2012, I was like, really?
Yeah, when you just said that, I was like, oh, I definitely didn't watch the third one either, because I did not know it was 2012. That's more recent than I thought it was.
Yeah, but anyways, so yeah, it seems like we're all that like we're familiar with it, I don't know, hazy memory kind of train. So we'll come back around to our actual first question. Did you like this movie, Men in Black International, Kat?
I did. I enjoyed it. It didn't blow me away in any sort of fashion. But because I don't have a lot of strong feelings about the Men in Black trilogy, what I was really going for was Tessa and Chris, because I love them. Their chemistry in Thor Ragnarok is something that makes that movie one of my favorite movies of all time. So I was super excited to see them again in like a buddy cop situation. So I was really going for them, and I was satisfied with their performances and their like relationship together. I really enjoyed that. But story wise, it was fine.
My answer is more or less the same. I mean, yes, like Tessa Thompson and Chris Hemsworth is like, that's the reason that I wanted to go see this movie. Like here in the year of our Lord 2010, like I want to go see a Tessa Thompson, Chris Hemsworth movie. Like, great, cool. My expectations were pretty low. I expected like romp, basically. And more or less it was that. It was a sort of fluffy nothing plot wise, but I enjoyed Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson, and like, I don't know, I laughed. It was fun. Mm-hmm. Fun, if perhaps forgettable.
Yes, I thought so too. Like, I thought it was fine as well. I am, because I'm such a rereader, rewatcher, I always think of this in terms of like, would I watch it again? And for this movie, like, sure, I would, but I wouldn't like seek it out anywhere. Like, if I were channel surfing and it was like, oh, Men in Black International is on, I would stop on it, but I wouldn't necessarily be like, you know what I want to watch right now? A 2019 classic, Men in Black International. So it was fine. I enjoyed myself. I was in the movie. I didn't hate the money that I spent on that movie ticket. Like, it was fine. I don't have any like strong feelings outside of that. So
I feel like the same as that, but like maybe one step up. So I wouldn't spend additional money to see it again, but I might like search for it on Netflix one day.
I would agree with that too. I wouldn't go see it again in the theater or anything, but when it's on Netflix, I probably will watch it again. But again, that's just because I love Tessa and Chris together so much.
Right, yes, that's precisely the reason for it. Will not be because I'm like, ooh, let me see this story again.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like you've maybe already answered this question, but obviously the big pull here is Tessa Thompson and Chris Hemsworth. Were you satisfied, I guess, with their performances and like the chemistry and all of that jazz? Because it was obviously no Thor Ragnarok, and I don't think it's fair to make that comparison necessarily, right, but they're right. The two leads from that movie like transported somewhere else. So how'd you feel about them here?
I liked them. I feel like I liked Tessa more than I liked Chris in this movie. I just feel like we got a much stronger connection with her since we got to see more of like an origin story for her, where we didn't get that as much with Chris's character. But I loved both of their performances. Yeah,
I totally agree. I was sure that Chris Hemsworth was also going to have been like body snatched. Like I thought that's where we were going with the whole the alien who was like, you've changed. And so obviously, like they resolved this, that the thing that happened was that he had had his memory wiped. But there were definitely a few places in which his performance, for the reason that like he had had his memory wiped, I guess, felt a little bit flat in a couple places. But for the most part, you know, he was like delightful and charming, and Tessa Thompson was fantastic throughout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I also felt that it was a little bit flat, but I guess my hangup is less with their performances and more with that there was precisely like one really funny character in this to me. And there wasn't a lot of like humor for them, which, I think that, I don't know, there was something about it that they didn't have a lot of that comedic timing sort of stuff to like play off of, which kind of disappointed me at times a little bit. Disappointed is a strong word. Like, I enjoyed this. It was fine. It was just sometimes a little flat, I think. But I don't entirely think that's their fault as actors. I thought the material was a little flat at times.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yes. And even the thing about Chris Hemsworth, yes, like I retract my statement about his performance being flat, because I agree. Like, I don't think that's actually what was going on there. It wasn't that his performance was flat. It was just that there wasn't really like much there. Right. So like there was nothing for me to sort of latch onto as an audience member, but I wouldn't necessarily put that on him.
Yeah. They didn't give him much to work with. Like I couldn't really tell you anything about his character. With Tessa, she had ambition, she had a goal, she was like really committed to this, but his character was just kind of there, and like I couldn't really tell you like what his ambitions were, what he wanted. Did he have a goal at all? Like, he just seemed to kind of be there.
And you could almost argue, like, again, that there is a narrative explanation for this in the memory wipe, but I mean, one, that's a pretty small memory wipe, and two, that is an explanation that doesn't come until the very end of the movie. So like, we have to watch this character, like, you have to give us something for the entire movie that we're following this character.
Right now, this movie is sitting at a 24% on Rotten Tomatoes. So it's not being well received at all, and so I don't know, I guess I kept thinking about my experience as I was leaving the theater, because I kind of immediately knew like that was fine. And I was leaving. There was like an older couple walking behind me, and the wife turned to him and was like, "What did you think?" And his response was, "Well, I thought it needed more Will Smith." And so, Sure, sir. I appreciate that sentiment. But I think there's something to be said here about this being like a spinoff / reboot, and kind of getting that comparison, and then also getting the Ragnarok comparison, and just like the idea of like letting this exist on its own versus people comparing it to what came before it. I don't know if that seems right to you guys, or why you think that this has been so badly received overall.
Well, I think the Rotten Tomatoes rating is a little bit harsh. It definitely wasn't the most amazing movie, but it was fun. It was entertaining. You know, it delivered kind of what it promised. Space romp with Tessa and Chris.
Yes. All elements present.
Yeah. I mean, some of this is also just like how Rotten Tomatoes works. I believe that it's like that it aggregates in a fairly flat, like good, bad way.
Yeah.
So like it's not, you know, it's not super fine grained. Right. And so like if you lean, I don't know, like I feel like the way that we answer that initial question, it would turn us into like tomato, tomato splat, right? Like, and so, which is like not, you know, a particularly thorough or holistic, I guess, assessment. So like some of it is that number like what that, I don't know, what does that number actually mean? I don't know. But also I agree, like that definitely feels way too harsh. I don't know. I laughed a lot. It was funny. It was not thoughtful humor, but it was like light and fluffy and whatever. Mari and I talked about this a little bit when we both saw Dark Phoenix separately, but on the same day, because that also has a slightly higher, like it's in the 40s or something maybe. I haven't looked at it, but at the time that we were talking about it, it was somewhere thereabouts, which also felt like a little too low for what it was. I was like, this is, you know, like pretty much like a perfectly fine movie. It's definitely not the best movie I've ever seen, but one of the first reviews that I clicked on of it was basically, it was a superhero movie. And I'm like, well yes, it was a superhero movie. And like, basically the complaint was, you know, it didn't do anything genre defying. And, you know, that's sort of the expectation. And I don't know, I'm rambling now. I think that there is something to this reaction that is like, about whether or not things can just be okay, which I'm assuming where you were kind of going with this question. And I don't really know, I don't have like a clean or simple answer to it, except that it feels a little bit like no, things are not allowed to just be okay.
Right. People put so many expectations on it. Like it has to be amazing or it's trash.
Right. Yes.
And there's so much like extra room between amazing and trash. Right? And I think that honestly,
most things exist in that space. Amazing and trash.
I exist in that. Right.
Nicole, just okay.
But also, I don't know, like, I feel like there is value in the okay too. Like, I feel like it sounds kind of exhausting to watch either only amazing things or only trash things. Like, there's right. times that you very much crave, like, just okay. And I don't know, like, I think we don't give enough credit to those sorts of movies that are just entertainment or that allow you to kind of like relax or turn your brain off or any of those things, in a way that I think that this one was. But so I don't know if that is like a product of the time we're living in or if it is a product of like critiques in general of what, you know, like the way that critique lends itself to looking for something that is above and beyond, or if like for Dark Phoenix and this movie, they come on the ends of movies that were arguably better. And so that comparison then makes it harder to just acknowledge that it was okay and move on.
Yeah, I think it's all of that. It's a lot of factors. And also the fact that in this day and age, there are so many things that we can be watching, reading, listening to, so many things demanding our attention that, you know, we have to kind of be a little bit choosy with what we give our attention to. So people tend to gravitate more like, you know, if it's not amazing, then why would I waste my time on it?
And then like getting mad at the movie for taking their time.
Yeah.
I also think that part of it is just like the role of media criticism is different now, and so that's another piece of it. Like it is obviously there still exists a professional class of media reviewers, like that job is a thing, but it exists far less with far less hierarchy than it used to because of social media. And I mean, like literally us, like this thing that we're doing right now exists in this weird sort of gray space. You know, like we are not we are not professional media critics. And yet, you know, here we are distributing our media opinions to hundreds of people.
Tens of hundreds. Yeah.
You know, so like, what does that mean? How does that affect all of this? I don't know. Like that is sort of messy and complicated, but I think something in that, in it, like both because everybody, you know, like if you're going to participate in the conversation, you're participating because you have a strong feeling, right? Like a non-opinion, like there's nothing, you know, you're not going to bring your non-opinion to the conversation, right? So generally that opinion is going to be like, I love this or I fucking hate this. So like, that's why you're entering the conversation in the first place. And then also there is the need to be heard within the conversation. And so you need to present the version of the thing that will cause people to pay attention to your sort of take. And so I think that also factors into all of this in terms of like why a thing can't just be okay.
Right. You have to lean hard one direction or the other, because, you know, what's going to get attention is this movie was trash or this movie was amazing, but this movie was fine. Like, no one's going to care to read that.
Right. I think this is really interesting to me. And I know we're kind of like grasping here at like all of the different directions that this goes in, but as somebody who does this thing and who like reviews things online, I think that I have certainly felt the pressure of like this idea of having like a refined palate because I review things. You know what I mean? Like,
yes, totally.
That if I were to say like, I enjoyed this, that people would be like, oh, you enjoyed that. So then it becomes necessary to be like, oh, okay, hold on and backtrack and like acknowledge that the plot was not the best and, you know, get into all of that because it feels like whether it's self-imposed or not, but because I do this thing for an audience that, I don't know, Your brand
is at stake.
Right.
Right. Your reputation, your credibility. Yes.
Right. Especially when it gets to a point where people are like, well, I watched that because you said it was good. And I'm like, oh no, you're $10. Like, damn it. Right.
you almost feel like you have to do a disclaimer before you say that you just have like an okay opinion. Like, okay, I understand that the plot was kind of messy and this character, whatever, but I still enjoyed it. Like, you can't just say, I enjoyed it. You have to put everything out there.
I don't know. That feels like a slightly different thing because you can if you're putting everything out there, then you can still land at it was okay, right? It's the, like, when you have the space, you know, like an hour long podcast or like a long form review, which again, I think going back to like this Rotten Tomatoes thing, like it's either like tomato or splat. Like it's, we're just looking for, is this review positive? And so there is probably a lot more, like if we're just going off of a Rotten Tomatoes score, it is entirely possible that there is a lot more like nuanced, it was okay, than what that number is capturing. So, right, like, you know, so there's, but when you have the space to explain all of the, here's what was good and here's what wasn't, and like, I don't know, yeah, it was okay. Like you can get at that, and then that still becomes, I don't know, then that's not like a non-opinion that you're sharing, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm curious for you guys in your own like choosing of media and stuff, when you see something that is like a book with a primarily 3-star review or a movie like this that IMDb score is like 5 out of 10. So there it's like a little more middling than the Rotten Tomatoes one. Is that something that you would still pick up and see for yourself, or does that sway your opinion?
It does sway my opinion. You know, I didn't see Dark Phoenix because it was getting very, you know, middle of the road reviews. I didn't see it in theaters. I probably will watch it when it comes out on Netflix or whatever streaming platform it comes out on later. But it depends on what draws me to the book or movie in the first place. Like, the main draw for this movie for me was Tessa and Chris. So even though it was getting those mediocre reviews, I was still on board to see it because I wanted to see them.
Right. Yes. And same for me, Dark Phoenix. Sophie Turner is in it. Cool. Great. I'm there. Super don't care what anybody else has to say about this movie. I will go see this Sophie Turner movie. I think it definitely, it's a factor. But like, you know, to kind of walk back some of my like very shorthand, like quick statements on, you know, professional reviewers and whatever, it also depends on who is giving the review. Like, I do read a lot of reviews. And so, I mean, like, so for this movie, I didn't, because I knew we had put it on the calendar as a podcast episode months ago. So I was like, okay, cool, whatever. Like, that's a movie I'm going to see. We're going to talk about it. It's going to be a thing, whatever. But like, you know, for something that I'm just deciding to watch or read or whatever on my own, like with books, you know, there are I know from all the BookTube that I'm watching whose tastes align with mine and in what ways. Like maybe there, you know, there are people whose tastes align with mine in a certain way, but you know, not in others. And you know, they'll say something that like, this book is good. I loved this book. It has this thing that I'm like, oh, normally our tastes are similar, but you love it because of this one trope that I actually happen to hate. So, you know, I know this thing isn't actually going to be for me, even though you, a person who I trust, love this book. I can tell there to stay away from it. But this again goes back to like spaces where there is more conversation than just yes, no.
Right.
I would mostly agree with that. I think that it matters to me who's giving the review. But also, I don't know, if I was interested in watching it for any reason at the beginning, even if it was getting bad reviews, like, come on, of course I'm going to like hate watch it or like go see for myself. Like I'm such that person that I'm like, well, I was going to watch it anyways. Might as well see or experience it for myself. So I'm not easily deterred from things.
It just changes. It changes the way that you go in though.
Right.
You'll still go in, but you'll go in differently.
If it's something that I'm just like kind of looking through and I don't know what I want to read, I'm just kind of looking through other people's stuff or reviews and it's like a 3-star book, I'm not going to pick that up. If it's something that I have an initial investment in, but people are not liking it, I will rely on that initial investment to see for myself, if that makes sense.
Yes, yeah. Totally. Which again, you know, like putting something on the podcast calendar, right? Like that's the kind of thing that I'm like, okay, well, you know, we're doing this. We would not have made the decision to not do this episode because the reviews are bad.
And you know, honestly, sometimes when something is getting a lot of, you know, it was okay or like mixed reviews, that just makes me more intrigued to, you know, watch it or read it to see for myself where I'll land.
Right. Right. Yes. Yes, totally.
And I think that especially happens with mixed reviews, where if it's like universally negative, you're kind of going in there being like, I'm doing this to myself. But if it's like middle of the road where some people are saying like, it was great. And some people are saying it was not great. Finding out where I land is like exciting. It's part of the enjoyable thing, you know, of going and experiencing that media.
Yeah. Like with this movie in particular, because of some of the reviews that were going out, I didn't have very high expectations. So I feel like I ended up enjoying it more than I thought I would because my expectations had been lowered. And I was just going for Tessa and Chris. And I just wanted like a fun, entertaining movie. And that's what I got. It was fun. It was fine.
Tessa and Chris in suits. Great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Delivered.
We're just going to rename the episode of this podcast to Tessa and Chris. I guess, honestly, there are other elements to this movie than just Tessa and Chris. Like, there was a plot and some other actors and some aliens and stuff. So maybe we should talk a little more about them after this, like, tangent into aggressively fine movies. Let's talk about the other elements of this movie. Were there any other things that you really enjoyed or any things that kind of tempered your experience?
Well, I mean, since I gushed about Chris and Tessa in suits, it must also be acknowledged that Emma Thompson wears a suit and looks great. So
this is true.
Other people in suits.
I liked Pawnee from the trailers. I wasn't necessarily expecting to because I thought he was going to be like an annoying character, but I ended up really enjoying him as like a sort of comedic sidekick.
Mm-hmm.
I did as well. I think that was like one of the like plus. It says CGI alien in my notes because I can't remember his name. But I mean, one of the more entertaining back and forth or scenes for me was where Pawnee was like passing messages between between Tessa and Chris, and just kind of adding his own spin on it. I thought that was really funny. Like, I don't know, there was something about his humor that it was a little on the nose or a little like in your face, but I enjoyed it. And I thought because some of the other plot was like missing that humor and felt a little flat, like he really revived a lot of the movie for me.
I think the thing about his humor was that a lot of it was like a little childish. And I feel like this movie is intended to be something that you can take your kids to, right? Like there were quite a few children in my theater when I was watching this movie, and like that seemed about right. I don't know, like the theater full of 10-year-olds.
Right. I wonder what their experience is like, because they're probably not familiar with the original Men in Black trilogy, and they may or may not be familiar with Ragnarok. So I wonder how this movie was as a first-time viewer into the Men in Black franchise.
I will say that all of the jokes landed in my theater. Mm-hmm. And again, this is a theater full, you know, there were many 10-year-olds in my theater. And so that seems like a big thing that stands out to me as maybe part of where the experience differs. I know, like, when Mari and I talked about it very briefly after I got out of the theater, you said that, like, you didn't laugh quite that much, right? So, like, Pawnee was basically the only, the sort of main source of humor that worked for you. I think there were other parts that got quite a few laughs in the theater that I was in, but some of that might have to do with the fact that there were so many children.
That kind of viewing experience is, like, infectious too.
Right.
Like,
absolutely.
You're like, all these people are enjoying
Everyone's
it.
Everyone's laughing. I'm laughing. Wow.
I have a question. What do you guys think could have been different about this movie to make it better? Because I've been thinking about this, and it's hard to pinpoint exactly what it was that just made it kind of underwhelming, like not amazing. It keeps coming back to the story for me, yes. How it was just very mediocre, like very predictable, which predictability isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it feels like it almost is in this day and age where everyone wants plot twists and surprises, and like you have to go above and beyond to impress someone.
See, I don't think that predictability is the problem here so much as like hollow. Like, it was just very hollow. I think the couple places where they tried to inject depth, like the whole sort of plot with Riza, whatever, and the kind of side conversation that Chris and Tessa have about being in love, that like that whole bit felt sort of out of place in this movie. You know, like, I think like the two of them had decent chemistry, and I don't object to, you know, the idea of them having like a romantic relationship in a future iteration of this, you know, future whatever, if they make more movies in this franchise, by all means go that route, that's fine. Like, my issue with it wasn't, no, don't do a romance plot, though I also don't think it's necessary. The way that they were hinting at it was just weird. Like, I like that sort of teasing out, like, so we when Tessa Thompson first, you know, finds her way to Men in Black, and like as she's pleading her case to Emma Thompson about why she should, you know, join the agency, she mentions that she like has no life. She has, you know, no one, nothing, whatever. Like, stuff like that is there, but it's never, you know, fleshed out or pursued in any meaningful way. And so it just, it felt very throwaway. And so, and like, that was kind of the case with everything, like plot wise in this. So I don't know. I think that they needed to add more weight to any of the little plot pieces that they kind of sprinkled throughout.
Yeah, it was kind of a lack of commitment. Like, yes, they had all these, yes, things that were like kind of there, but they didn't really commit to anything.
And I would even argue that my knee-jerk reaction is to say, like, add more depth in terms of, like, even they showed us a little like flashback of Tessa Thompson's early life and why she got interested in there, but there wasn't really an emotional connection of like what that past really meant to her future. So that would be like my initial thing, like add depth to her character, add depth to his character, and kind of take it from there. But alternatively, I feel like you could also take all of those little like hints of things completely away,
yes,
and go more ridiculous,
yeah,
or bigger or more faster, you know, more action packed sequences, more chases, more aliens, and then just kind of ramp it up that way, which is also a very viable kind of solution here. But I think that the middle of the road thing, where it was just like a sprinkling of character with a little sprinkling of action, left it in this weird middle ground where I was like, but now you're neither.
Yeah.
And
yes, yes, absolutely.
I will also say that, I don't know, the stakes here were, I don't know if this is oversaturation of like the aliens coming to destroy the whole world, and the fact that we have seen that story on a bigger scale, but the stakes didn't feel super high here. Like, I never really felt like something was going to go wrong or something was going to get us. But the, I'm assuming, actual twins that played the bad guys, the aliens or whatnot, I thought they gave like a really cool physical performance. And every time they were on the screen, I was like watching them and what they were doing, because they were really like creepy to watch. But also, I don't know, I was just, I thought that the stakes maybe weren't high enough.
I feel like they weren't really clear. Like, we didn't even know what that item was until halfway through the movie. We didn't really have any idea of, like, what was at risk.
I mean, that all was attached to the one alien that was a friend of Chris Hemsworth, who dies very early on and is like, protect this with your life. But we don't know who that guy is either.
Yeah.
And everything we've told about him before that point made him seem kind of scummy, honestly. Mm-hmm. And then so then they just kill him and they're like, protect this with your life. And I'm like, I don't know who you are.
Yeah.
Dirtbag. Like, I'm not sure why I'm supposed to be invested in this other than like the mystery, like, what is it kind of portion. Mm-hmm. But it takes too long to get us there to the point where we find out what it is. So had they made that a character that you could invest more feelings in, or like, I don't know, made his death a little more punchy or impactful, then we have a reason to care about this. But as it played out, we really didn't.
Yeah. I think this goes back to what you were saying before about like, either you lean into, you know, building out these characters, or like you scrap some of the kind of sprinklings of death and you go more romp, because like there were too many different things going on, because we have initial plot thread, right, is Molly's journey to have this dream come true and understand the universe. Like, that's her goal. Her stated goal is that she wants to understand how it all works. Then we also have these, I don't know, well, the sort of the idea of like the apocalypses happening, apocalyptic events kind of happening over and over again in the background. That's sort of like the gag of it all, right? That like, this is a thing, you know, this just happens. And Chris Hemsworth keeps saving the earth. Okay, that's fine. But then within kind of the actual structure of the movie, you have both this like spy intrigue thing of, you know, we have a double agent somewhere inside the house. And like this heist thing of we have to go and like steal back the object. Like there are just like, those are sort of three distinct things kind of happening all at once and sort of competing with one another for your full attention and for, I think, the screenwriter's full attention. And I think that is also a big part of why it didn't all come together.
Yeah, especially because some of those individual storylines just weren't resolved in a satisfying way. Like, specifically with the twins, when they were just like killed and it was just like, oh, they're done. Like, they've been built up as like this very powerful like villain for most of the movie. And then Liam comes in and just like gets rid of them at this key moment. And it's just like, oh, okay, they're defeated. They're done.
That part doesn't bother me because of the way that it plays into the twist that Liam is like actually the big, big bad. Hmm. Right. So like that's sort of the things that they have been presented as this very big bad. And then, you know, they're defeated immediately. Liam Neeson shows up and then defeats them immediately. And like, that's weird. You know, I don't know. That piece of it, I think, is that part didn't bother me quite as much as some of the other like open-ended things. But in general, I agree that there were quite a number of things that weren't wrapped up as satisfyingly as I would have liked.
Hey, here's like a thing that maybe is now a thing for me. So this felt, hearing you talk about it or explain it that way, made me think immediately of Game of Thrones, where it was like the zombie war. And then it was like fake out, actually the last war or whatever.
Right.
I don't like stories where you spend the majority of the time invested in thinking that one thing is like the big bad or the end game for the story, only to fake you out and say like it was this all along. I only have two examples, but now I feel like I don't like those stories.
Okay. In defense of those stories, these are not great examples. However, I also think that part of what I am getting at is that, like, I don't know. I don't think that it was a complete fake out to then have Liam Neeson be the big bad. Like, I don't know. It was pretty clear for a while that based on the twins, like based on what we saw happen there, that the hive, that's what it was, the hive from the, you know, prologue-y apocalypse, that like something went down there and that somebody from the hive was inside Men in Black. And so I spent a lot of the movie thinking it was Chris Hemsworth. And I think that was kind of intentional also with the, you know, you've changed, like the movie wanted you to think that, right? So, but like the twist that, or the movie also maybe wanted you to consider that it was Agent C. Sure. So I think maybe more could have been done to suggest the possibility of Liam Neeson, but like, I don't know, not really. Like, he and Chris Hemsworth were both like, that makes sense to me. All of that makes sense, that Liam Neeson is the person who was infected by the hive, body snatched by the hive. I don't know how you want to describe it. The movie doesn't really describe it. So whatever it was that happened to Liam Neeson, I think like the movie definitely teased the idea that this was a thing that had happened. And so like the ultimate twist, I don't think that this is a like shock and awe twist, I guess, is where I'm going with that. Because I am also inclined to dislike anything that feels like a twist for its own sake, which I think was often a problem that I had with Game of Thrones. I don't think this was a twist for its own sake.
Now we're going to just like go back and forth on this single plot point, but listen.
That's correct. This is basically the only real plot point.
So. Right?
That's true. Well, the Game of Thrones thing wasn't a twist either. The fact that it was zombies and then Cersei, we knew that. Mm-hmm. The thing that like bothered me was that I didn't know that after investing so much time in zombies first, that by the time they were like defeated in a single episode, that I would feel so like, well, ugh, now about like dealing with the rest of it, which is kind of the same way that I felt about this movie, especially because I guess, you know, the thing was that like the hive had infiltrated the Men in Black, but I can more easily understand what it would mean for the hive to destroy the world, which is what we thought these twins were doing, versus like, oh no, somebody betrayed us in the organization, which obviously there was a bigger part of that too, because the hive was still trying to destroy the world, but that it felt like an investment, and that moment did feel kind of like a letdown or a drop in pace in a movie that otherwise was struggling a little bit for like those quicker moments.
I think part of what I was getting at isn't so much like I agree with you in both of these cases that sort of what follows the twist to like, no, actually look over here, it was unsatisfying. But I don't think that I guess what I'm saying is that I don't think that that is just about no, wait, look over here. Like all of these things that you are talking about are just like there's just, you know, lazy narrative structure involved in what happens after the like, no way, look over here. And I am saying that I don't think that that is bad on its face, that like that it is just a matter of, if you're going to say no way, look over here, then like what's over here has to be really compelling. And it just wasn't in this case, or in the case of Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I think it was less of a fake out and more of just an abrupt swerve that wasn't quite earned.
Yeah.
And I also wonder, like, what was Liam or the Hive, like, what was that character's game plan? Because, like, we didn't know that this weapon existed. We didn't know, like, what were they doing in the Men in Black for so long, just kind of chilling, not taking over the world, running the company?
They were luring that alien to Earth.
But it sounded like that alien had been at Earth before. I guess that was before.
No, that was, yes. He like he just showed up and then he was at this nightclub. I don't know, like this alien who's guarding like the most powerful weapon in the universe. Like, he maybe should have taken his job a little bit more seriously. My understanding is that the Hive like was using Liam Neeson's position to lure, like, yeah, do things to lure that alien to Earth so that they could then steal that thing.
Yeah, but we didn't really see a plan from him going after that alien. It wasn't until the twins had the weapon and were like on the or had attempted to get the weapon that he seemed to even know it existed.
I'm just enjoying myself so much. I'm like back here giggling because it's like the three of us trying to talk about this movie we all recently saw. It's completely unmemorable, like referring only to things like the aliens, the weapon, and the characters by their actor names. Like, this is amazing.
Yep, that's correct. I feel like that's a very solid summary of this movie-going experience.
And I feel like analyzing it is hard because there's not enough material for us to work with. Like, the story just wasn't well thought out.
That's why we talked about reviews for half of this conversation.
Swerve. So,
did we earn it? I don't know. Tell us.
You know, I saw an article last night that mentioned that part of the reason this movie kind of was all over the place was because it was a lot of different people in the studio reaching in and like trying to direct it in their way. And it just got messy in a studio behind the scenes way, which is disappointing.
Yes, always disappointing. I just want to like a brief shout out also for, this is like a moment in the trailer, but it was still totally just as satisfying to see it in the movie, for like Chris Hemsworth's like proud of himself thumbs up when he amends his statement to like the men and women in black. I don't know. It just gets me. Got me every time I saw it in the trailer. Got me in the theater.
I thinking about that moment too, like again, coming off the heels of watching Dark Phoenix, where Jennifer Lawrence's character, Mystique, has that one moment too that she like yells at Professor X, like, you should just rename it X-Women because the women are always saving the men around here. And it makes me laugh, one, because I mean it knew me as the audience, and yes, that kind of thing is always gonna land. But it makes me kind of laugh at the way that these franchises that are like old have to probably constantly deal with this, like Men in Black, X-Men. Right. They're even in like the show Supergirl. She like very early on in the season, she has this whole like thing about like, why not Superwoman? And it's, I don't even remember what explanation that they came up with, why it's Superman and Supergirl and not Superwoman. Right. But they have to address these things, right? That are like, they didn't come up with, but I don't know, you just got to deal with now. So I appreciated that they did it with a little bit of humor and gave him his little thumbs up moment.
Right. The fact that it was humor and also self-awareness, like that moment, like, you know, and like him having that moment and then Tessa Thompson's, okay, dude, like focus on the problem at hand reaction. Like also, you know, this is, you know, classic, like, so do you want a cookie? Like for that, like, everything about that brief little exchange was like, yes, you have communicated so much.
My little moment of like, oh, okay, this is, you know, it landed, it's on the nose, but I don't care, I love it, was during a fight sequence with Chris Hemsworth, that at one point he picks up a little baby hammer.
Yes.
And oh, yeah.
And I'm like, a hammer! And I thought it was just really cute, especially because he promptly gets knocked out and does nothing with the hammer.
Yeah.
That's a nod to the fact that all three of us were there for Tessa and Chris.
Right. I was sitting next to a woman and a bunch of, you know, I don't know, 10-ish year old kids. And the woman had a very intense audible reaction to that bit. And then like turns and explains to like the kid, basically it was like me, kid, her, and then kid, like down. But then she like turns to the kid next in between the two of us and like explains the joke to him. And it was just, I don't know, like I could hear how delighted she was about it. And that also, that made me appreciate it even more. The other one too is shortly after they first meet, when they have like a "Do I know you?" moment with Chris and Tessa. That was also like a fun little give me more of these little these little in jokes for the audience.
Remind me more of the other better movie that actually brought me here.
Remember, you love these this other movie with these two people. Think about that.
It's kind of funny that the movie is self-aware enough to know that, like, we're going to enjoy these things more because of, like, cultural context of other things. Mm-hmm. Like, it's very much, like, almost fan service-y, kind of.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, very much so. That is a whole other, you know, half an hour long sidebar, like, the concept of fan service. Like, I don't say that disparagingly in any, in general. Like, I don't associate that term as being, as possessing any sort of moral quality, though I think it does for some people. But, like, right. Definitely I would describe this as fan service.
Yeah, I don't think it's a negative. I enjoyed it.
I was served.
Yeah.
I am a fan. I was served.
Like, that's what I was there for. So, yes. You know, good job.
And on that note, thank you all so much for listening. And thank you to Kat for joining us this week. We'd love to hear all of your thoughts on Men in Black International, if you have them, but also on movies that are just okay. There will be a post dedicated to this episode up on SnarkSquad.com. You can also sign up to join our community on Patreon.com/SnarkSquad. And there you will find polls, live hangouts, and other bonus content. You can also find us on Twitter at @Snark_Squad. You can find me at My Name is Marines.
I am at Sweeney Says.
And I am at @Cat_Tastic.
Thank you as always to Stefan Chin for the theme music that is playing us out right now, and we will be back in your feed next week. Bye.
Bye. Bye.